to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the third podcast episode on perinatal mental health. We made these episodes in collaboration with the National Curriculum in Reproductive Psychiatry X Obstetrics Group, or NCRP-XOB. Today, we will focus on crisis situations in the outpatient setting. Joni, I'm really bummed that it's our final episode in the NCRP-XOB PMAD podcast series.
I am too. It's been fun to chat with you. But if you, the listener, are interested in learning more, the National Curriculum in Reproductive Psychiatry, or NCRP, has online modules about perinatal mental health for classroom and individual learning, as well as extended content designed specifically for obstetrics providers. It won't be with us, but it'll be really great information. You can check that out on the NCRP website, ncrptraining.org. As a reminder, my name is Joni Libert. I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner who works in maternal mental health in Utah.
And I'm Lauren Gimbel, an OBGYN at the University of Utah.
And in this episode, we'll talk about suicide and crisis situations, particularly in clinic. We'll discuss how to evaluate your patient and what to do next when you discover there's a concern for their safety.
That's perfect. So let's get into the objective specifically for this episode. To identify the prevalence of suicide in pregnant and postpartum patients, to describe risk factors for suicide, to learn how to assess a patient's acute suicide risk, and to identify appropriate levels of care for a patient.
So let's get into it. Suicide is a leading cause of death for postpartum patients. Screening for postpartum depression, specifically the EPDS or PHQ-9, may uncover suicidal ideation. It is vital to evaluate further and determine the most appropriate level of care.
Suicide prevalence ranges from around 1 to 5 per 100,000 live births. Suicide is most common between 9 and 12 months postpartum. Prior to suicide, around 45% of individuals have had contact with a primary care provider. Infanticide, when the individual kills their baby, is about 2 to 7 per 100,000 live births. Risk factors for suicide are a personal history of suicide attempts, family history of completed suicide, severe mental illness, specifically bipolar disorder, access to lethal means, intimate partner violence, stillbirth, suicidal intent or plan, poor sleep, self-neglect, lack of interest in the child, and postpartum psychosis.
Screening tools like the EPDS question number 10 and PHQ-9 question number 9 ask about suicide. If the patient answers in the positive, you have tools to risk stratify the patient to decide the best course of action. Utilizing the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale can help you in a busy clinic or in further understanding their suicide risk, in addition to guiding a further discussion with the patient. The Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale is often embedded in the electronic medical record, but if it's not, it's available for free by searching for it online. By utilizing the EPDS or PHQ-9, you can screen for suicide at every visit through the first year postpartum.
If a patient screens positive for suicidal ideations, how do you assess their risk of suicide in clinic?
You can address their answer on a positive screen directly. Say something like, "I really appreciate you filling out the depression screening tool today. I did notice that you answered yes to having thoughts of hurting yourself and wanted to talk more about this." Normalize their answer when bringing it up with them. You can say something like, "A lot of individuals during pregnancy postpartum can have thoughts of hurting themselves. Can you tell me more about your thoughts?" Give them space to then talk. Allow it to be silent to give them time to think it over. If they said they accidentally checked yes, then you can say, "I'm glad to hear this isn't going on, but if that ever changes in the future, please bring it up and let's talk more about it."
There are a few elements that are helpful to clarify for risk assessment of completing suicide. First, assess if their suicidal ideation is active or passive. One way to do this in clinic, I'm just going to give you some verbiage that I use that can be helpful, is to ask or state, "Sometimes patients have thoughts that they no longer want to be alive. Has that happened to you?" And then if the individual says yes, then I say, "Have you thought about killing yourself?" And again, if they respond as yes, then I say, "Can you tell me more?"
Passive suicidal thoughts sound like, "I just wish I could go to sleep and not wake up," or "I wish I could just disappear." Active suicidal thoughts may sound like, "I want to kill myself." If they do have active suicidal ideation, then assess plan, means, and intent. How are they planning to harm themselves? Have they selected a date or time to follow through with this plan? How close have they come to following through on their plan? Do they have access to the means of suicide they prefer? Have they started collecting the means or begun writing a suicide note? For example, if they plan to kill themselves using pills, do they have pills at home that they would take?
Even if they are not intending to use guns, you need to ask them about their access to guns, because a suicide attempt with a gun normally ends in death. If they do have access to guns, are they locked away? If the guns are locked away with a code or key, do they have the key or know the code to get them? Easy access to guns can make an impulsive suicidal thought turn into a completed suicide. It is always important to assess if their thoughts are current or past. Were these thoughts last month and now they're feeling better, or are they current? Do they have any deterrents? For example, some individuals may say, I've thought I'd be better off dead, but I would never do anything. I care too much about my kids.
What do you do if they do not have a plan?
If they do not have plans, you can ask, what is preventing you from creating a plan? And if that changed, what would you do and who would you tell? This can be a good time to start safety planning with them. One idea for a way to word it is, I don't think this is going to happen, but if your mood were to worsen, who would you tell? Once they answer, you can respond, I want you to tell this person, whether it's their partner, parent, whoever they listed, that your mood is worsening, and then call this crisis line. The people who work on this crisis line will not come and get you, but they will help you talk through a good plan to make sure that you and your baby are safe. Utilize your prior mental health history or obtain it at this point. Do they have a history of self-harm or a prior attempt? If they do have a history, when was the last time they self-harmed or attempted? What did they use? What ended up happening? Individuals with prior suicide attempts, self-harm history, and psychiatric hospitalization are at a higher risk of suicide. This is especially true if they have a high number of attempts, high number of hospitalizations, or if their attempt has been recent. Obtain their family history, including a history of suicide. Directly ask them, has a family member of yours died by suicide? Do you have a family member who self-harms? Also, be sure to ask, do any of your family members have bipolar disorder?
I know these time periods in clinic when a patient expresses suicidal ideation can be really anxiety-provoking for the obstetrician. I want to make sure I have this clear. When I find out that a patient has suicidal ideation in clinic, I should perform their risk assessment by finding out if their thoughts are passive or active, and if they are active, determining their plan, intent, and means, along with completing my psychiatric history if I haven't already done that.
Well said. In addition, ask if their thoughts are current or past, and what, if any, deterrents they have. But by that time, you probably already have an idea of their risk category. Low-risk individuals will be those with passive suicidal ideation. They can state their thoughts are just thoughts, do not have a plan, and can state reasons they want to be alive. Your high-risk individuals will be those with active suicidal ideation and a plan. They've determined the means and have some degree of intent and may be starting to lose their deterrence. Another thing to keep in mind is bipolar disorder and postpartum psychosis. If the patient appears off and exhibits symptoms of a manic episode with fast talking, grandiosity, no sleep, with feeling energized, etc., or if they exhibit symptoms of postpartum psychosis with bizarre behavior, delusions, hallucinations, or waxing and waning moods, then they are placed in a high-risk category regardless of suicidality.
What's the next step after risk stratification?
If you determine the individual to be low-risk with passive suicidal ideation, they are suitable for outpatient care. These patients should be treated based on underlying diagnosis. For most patients, like those with severe depression and or anxiety, they should be treated with medications, therapy, a referral to a psychiatric provider unless they're already seeing one, and close follow-up. If they already have a psychiatric provider, have them follow up with them. Otherwise, start or increase their medication based on their underlying mental health diagnosis. Inquire if they have a therapist or provide referrals for therapists, and refer to a psychiatrist or psych nurse practitioner. Sometimes you can titrate their medications to a level that improves their mental health and resolves their suicidal ideation while waiting for their referral appointment. If they improve, you or their primary care provider can manage their medications as long as they are being closely followed by their therapist and monitored by their support system. If they are not improving or stay the same, they should see the psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner that you referred them to.
What if I determine that the individual is high risk?
If you determine the individual to be high risk with active suicidal ideation, the patient needs immediate psychiatric evaluation. If you have outpatient assistance while in clinic, you can utilize that resource for a full evaluation of safety and potential inpatient admission. Some behavioral health programs are built into the outpatient clinic. If so, contact the behavioral health provider and request an evaluation of your patient for active suicidal ideation. If your institution has another protocol, follow their protocol. Otherwise, utilize a crisis assessment center near you or send them to the emergency department for a psychiatric evaluation, as they may need hospitalization. Hospitalization is used to ensure the patient is not a threat to themselves or others, but also allows for more rapid titration of medications under direct observation, helping them feel better sooner. In addition, it typically allows for more sleep than they are getting at home and gets them connected to behavioral health services in a timelier manner. Remember that high-risk patients make teamwork essential. These patients call for a warm handoff if you're referring or collaboration of care if the patient already has a psychiatric practitioner.
What if the patient refuses to talk with a behavioral health specialist, or after talking with them decides to go home and wants to be managed as an outpatient?
These high-risk patients should really be managed by a psychiatrist or behavioral health specialist. The obstetrician's role is to ensure that the patient is getting evaluated and support them in continuing to follow up with a behavioral health specialist or psychiatrist. I think it's helpful to know that anytime a patient is hospitalized for psychiatric reasons, the most ideal way for the individual to enter hospitalization is voluntary admission. The psychiatrist will be the one coordinating this aspect.
Sounds great. That's really helpful to know that the most ideal situation is for voluntary admission.
Yeah, so you may be the first person to suggest inpatient hospitalization, or the patient may ask what your opinion is on them going into the hospital. In a perfect world, the inpatient unit either has a reproductive psychiatrist or a perinatal or postpartum friendly unit. However, as their obstetrician, you may need to be available to advocate for the patient. Oftentimes, the mental health benefits of sleep outweigh the benefits of breastfeeding. Some individuals may still choose to breastfeed, and the inpatient team may have questions regarding this. Ideally, these patients are connected to psychiatry and psychotherapy, and medication is increased or initiated for their underlying condition. If you find yourself in one of these situations, either you or the behavioral health specialist, if you have one available at your institution, can also call a family member to talk through warning signs and a safety plan. Family members or loved ones are integral in these situations. Calling the family for collateral information can be helpful in your risk assessment. Including family in the care can increase openness within the patient support system and can be used to develop a safety plan at home as well as a plan if they worsen. If you're talking with a family before an emergency happens, first get permission from the patient to talk with family members. However, in an emergency situation, if there is imminent threat to the health or safety of themselves or others, you may call the family member without getting permission from the patient first.
How do you ask the patient for permission to talk with a family member before an emergency situation occurs?
Asking something like, if anything worsened, who can we talk to now so we can develop a plan together that keeps you safe? If they have guns or accessible means at home, you could also ask, can we talk with your partner about hiding the key to the gun safe or changing the code? Drawing in a family member or loved one can be helpful when you are concerned about suicidal ideation, hypomanic or manic behavior, or psychosis. I'll say personally that I have a sibling with bipolar disorder, and it was my sister who was living with him, not me, who specializes in this, who picked up on the mania first and recognized that there was something different going on with him.
That's a great point, and I'm so glad that your sister was living with your brother at the time. If you plan to practice obstetrics, it's a good idea to ask your practice after you join if they have an emergency evaluation protocol in place, because you will be screening for PMADs and you will have individuals who screen positive for suicidal ideation. If there is no protocol in place, talk with your partners about how they handle these psychiatric emergencies, research nearby crisis assessment centers that you could refer to, or see if your state has an accessible crisis program to assist in the outpatient setting.
Lastly, if you're going to be sending a patient in crisis to a crisis assessment center or the emergency department, you need to think about transport. Are they safe to leave your office and go to the center? Do they have a family member with them that will drive them? And if not, who on your clinic staff can you reach out to for help in coordinating this?
I feel like I've learned so much in how to address these situations in the outpatient setting. What if you just can't figure out if the patient is high risk or low risk for suicide completion or infanticide?
Remember that you're never alone, and you can utilize resources to help you make this decision. You can utilize outpatient assistance while in clinic, such as a behavioral health team who can evaluate the patient while they're in your office. If this is not available to you, get the patient to a nearby outpatient crisis assessment center where a behavioral health specialist can evaluate the patient for safety and possible inpatient admission. If you're unsure, gather further collateral from the family after asking the patient for permission. Err on the side of obtaining a psychiatric evaluation through an outpatient crisis assessment center or outpatient behavioral health if that's available to you. And if you don't have any of those resources available to you, err on the side of caution and make sure the patient gets to the emergency department.
Otherwise, there are access programs in some states where the obstetrician can call a psychiatric access line. They can help in evaluating the patient through telehealth or phone if the patient is not in a clear emergency, but is still in an urgent situation or a higher risk patient that you are unsure what to do with their medications or treatment plan. While it differs by state program, they can offer help with diagnosis clarification, medication changes as you await long-term outpatient behavioral health care, and some can even help connect the patient to a behavioral health follow-up team. If your state does not have an access program, we mentioned this in the first episode, but you can use the PSI Access Program phone line, although it can take up to 2 days to receive a call back from a psychiatrist and will not be as helpful in these more urgent situations in clinic. This is different than the PSI helpline for patients. It's specifically for healthcare providers who want direct access to a reproductive psychiatrist. I know that that was a lot of information, but it's really helpful to remember that you're not alone, even at those moments when it occurs in clinic. What other resources are available to you that you can use at that time? What if a patient presents in clinic in a hypomanic or manic state? And can you remind me what those states are?
Yeah, so you may see individuals in your clinic with a first-time bipolar episode or recurrence, and they're presenting in a hypomanic or manic episode. Clinical features of mania include elevated or irritable mood, increased self-esteem or grandiosity, decreased need for sleep, rapid speech, racing thoughts or flight of ideas, being easily distractible, increased goal-directed activity, and increased high-risk behavior, including spending lots of money, using substances, or high-risk sexual behaviors. The hypomanic episode must last at least 4 days for bipolar 2 disorder and at least 1 week for bipolar 1 disorder. If the patient has required hospitalization or has accompanying psychosis, the diagnosis is bipolar 1 disorder. Additionally, the mania cannot be due to a substance.
Let's say that you have a postpartum patient who explains to you that they've been up for the past 2 nights drinking coffee to stay awake for the baby because the baby's not sleeping. They don't feel tired during the day. Is this person in a manic episode?
Yeah, that's a good clarifying question. No, because the increased energy is due to a substance and the quote episode lasts only 2 days. Regardless, you still want to emphasize the importance of sleep, collaborate with the partner or family member to support sleep, and maintain close follow-up.
What's the difference between a hypomanic or manic episode and postpartum psychosis?
So postpartum psychosis includes delusions, which are fixed false beliefs, paranoia, hallucinations, meaning hearing or seeing things that aren't there, and disorganized thoughts or behaviors. Disorganized thought may manifest as tangential, derailed, illogical, or even completely incomprehensible thought processes. Disorganized behavior may include odd, nonsensical, or unpredictable behavior. Some patients may simply struggle to meaningfully plan or complete goal-oriented tasks. Importantly, and unlike other purely psychotic illnesses, postpartum psychosis is an affective psychosis. This means that mood symptoms are also present and, in fact, prominent. The mood symptoms may be mania, depression, or a mixed episode. The term postpartum psychosis can be used for new-onset illness, but also applies to people with known bipolar disorder who present manic and psychotic in the postpartum period. Either way, it's an emergency.
Why is postpartum psychosis a psychiatric emergency?
Postpartum psychosis is a psychiatric emergency due to the high risk of maternal suicide, harm to the infant, and infanticide. Postpartum psychosis is a rare but serious disorder affecting approximately 1 to 2 per 1,000 postpartum women. Although the greatest risk factor is a prior history of postpartum psychosis or bipolar disorder, some patients presenting with postpartum psychosis have no previous mood episodes. A family history of bipolar disorder, particularly in first-degree relatives, also confers risk. Other risk factors include prematurity, advanced maternal age, and the occurrence of a mood disorder during pregnancy. Several distinct clinical features can help to distinguish postpartum psychosis from other acute psychiatric disorders. One of these clinical features is a waxing and waning course. Dr. Margaret Spinelli, a physician who is arguing for postpartum psychosis to be a unique diagnosis in the DSM, stated, "The cognitive or delirium-like state must be anticipated because of the waxing and waning confusion and disorientation that contributes to the mother's poor judgment and impulsivity. Waxing and waning such that the woman seems well at one moment and then floridly psychotic in the next may not be anticipated." Other distinct clinical features are delirium-like alterations in consciousness, confusion, thought disorganizations, and bizarre delusions. Mood symptoms such as mania, depression, or mixed states are always present. Again, that affective presentation. Delusional content may be focused on childbirth or the newborn, such as altruistic delusions of suicide or infanticide, or depressed psychotic thoughts, such as the baby being, quote, better off if the mother were dead. One study noted that around half of individuals had delusions related to the infant, although limited studies have investigated if there is commonality among delusions during pregnancy and postpartum. Perceptual disturbances may occur, such as auditory or visual hallucinations with direct commands for suicide or infanticide. Remember, because of the waxing and waning nature of this syndrome, the clinician should question the patient directly about the thoughts of suicide or infanticide at repeated intervals during the assessment.
Remember what we talked about in the anxiety episode. If the patient's delusions are egosyntonic, it is more likely postpartum psychosis and needs immediate psychiatric evaluation. Egosyntonic means that their thoughts are not concerning to them because they are in line with what they believe to be true. This is different than postpartum OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder because these individuals' thoughts are ego-dystonic and it's very disturbing to them. One example of egosyntonic thoughts in postpartum psychosis is a patient who has suicidal ideation and also is stating that they believe that the baby must live with God and they're trying to figure out ways to get the baby to God. Sometimes they might ask you for ideas, but they are not disturbed by these thoughts.
So let's summarize. Ideally, an emergency evaluation protocol should be in place prior to an emergency occurring. If you do not know the protocol when first starting at the practice you join, ask the clinical staff and your partners. When a patient presents with a psychiatric emergency, first, identify the working diagnosis. Suicidal or homicidal ideation, psychosis, mania, or delirium. For suicidal patients, risk stratify them into low or high risk based on active versus passive suicidal ideation. If they have active suicidal ideation, ask about plan, intent, means, and history. In high-risk patients, trigger an emergency psychiatric evaluation, whether that is an outpatient behavior health team evaluating the patient, a crisis assessment center, or sending the patient to the emergency department. Be sure to discuss transportation and decide if they are safe to leave the facility or not. At this time, a psychiatrist or behavioral health team will be leading care. But remember that if hospitalization is needed, voluntary admission is preferable.
Collaborate with the psychiatric team and family and identify roles within the perinatal and psychiatric team in relation to treatment and follow-up care. You will not likely be the primary outpatient follow-up provider, but schedule a time for the patient to follow up with you to discuss concerns regarding medications, breastfeeding, the postpartum period, or future pregnancies.
Let's say you have a patient in clinic with postpartum psychosis, like they're actively psychotic. Are there any recommendations for medication management while awaiting assessment from a behavioral health specialist?
In ACOG's clinical practice guideline on the treatment and management of mental health disorders during pregnancy and postpartum, they say that while postpartum psychosis is a psychiatric emergency, treatment options that are within the scope of obstetricians while awaiting further assessment recommendations in a treatment plan by the psychiatrist include sedating antipsychotic medications like olanzapine or haloperidol that can be used with benzodiazepines such as lorazepam. Remember that if you use haloperidol, you should also give benztropine or diphenhydramine at the same time to prevent extrapyramidal symptoms and dystonia. This is a good practice point from the clinical practice guidelines.
So for resources, each organization, clinic, and state likely have their own specific resources, but we'll list a few for you just as a foundation. This includes the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is now 988, really easy to remember, the Psychiatric Access Program in your state, and Postpartum Support International's Access Program to consult with a reproductive psychiatrist. MGH, Center for Women's Health, as well as NCRP offers provider resources, and you can go to their websites to learn more. Those are both linked in the show notes. We focus this episode on outpatient management of crisis situations, but for a more extended discussion of inpatient management, check out the NCRP XOB Educational Series.
The NCRP XOB Educational Series also goes into more detail than what we did today. Let's wrap up with a few key clinical points.
Be sure to examine screening questionnaires for suicide. Address patients who report that they are having suicidal ideations. Determine if patients with suicidal ideation are low or high risk for suicide based on active versus passive ideation, intent, and means, as well as their psychiatric history.
Triage patients to the appropriate level of care. Those who are low risk may be eligible for outpatient care. Start or increase a medication for their underlying disorder. Refer for psychotherapy if not already involved. And refer to psychiatry if they are willing and do not already have a psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner. Schedule a close follow-up with the patient to ensure they are improving. Those who are high risk for suicide, have symptoms of hypomania or mania, or present with postpartum psychosis are considered to be a psychiatric emergency and need immediate psychiatric evaluation.
Start the emergency evaluation protocol by getting your outpatient behavioral health team involved for an evaluation, having them go to a crisis assessment center or an emergency room. Ensure you are aware of the protocol at your institution, including considerations for transportation. Utilize family members or loved ones to obtain collateral information and incorporate them into the safety plan after receiving approval from the patient. And finally, debrief with your staff to ensure that if a crisis situation occurs again, everyone feels comfortable with the protocol.
Well, that concludes the NCRP XOB PMAD podcast series. We are always open to feedback on things you liked, things we could do better, and ways you would like to see this used. Were there resources that were not clear that you would like access to, or other parts in the episodes that you have questions about? We are always happy to help. Please reach out to us at sadmomsclubpodcast@gmail.com.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
Welcome to the Sad Moms Club.
To the Sad Moms.